human control.
Responsibility, accountability, trust.
Practical outputs to complex theoretical problems.
AI, autonomy, they're merely tools.
Control is not a binary concept.
So how confident am I that this system is going to behave in the way that I expect it to behave?
Can we really trust autonomous systems? Are our laws and policies keeping place with emerging technology? Who is accountable for the actions of an uncrewed or autonomous system? Hello and welcome to Adapting Army Podcast. Over this series, I'll be speaking to the movers and shakers who are leading into the future with innovative approaches and groundbreaking technologies. Today, we're joined by Colonel Damien Copeland, who is a Director of Operations and International Law, Department of Defence. Damien has immense experience in the legal review of weapons, specifically weapons and systems enhanced by artificial intelligence. You'll also hear from Dr. Zena Assad, who is a fellow with Trusted Autonomous Systems Defence Cooperative Research Centre and the Australian National University. Zena has made fundamental contributions to inform Army's understanding of the paradigm between trust and autonomous systems. In this episode, we'll discuss an example of when autonomous systems have been introduced into the public domain too early and the lessons learned from this scenario. We also explore what are the characteristics of a trusted system, the role of humans and accountability when using autonomous capabilities, and some of the policies and laws that are currently guiding the Army's development of emerging technology. Well, Zena and Damien, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us. Great to be here.
So we have a lot to discuss and learn from you in the coming hour or so. I want to start with why first, though. Can you both please give us your top-level answer, your go-to response, when you're asked the question, why is it important that there are legal and ethical considerations when looking at the development and potential use in time of conflict of AI and military technology in the Australian Army? Why are these considerations important?
From my perspective, I consider it important because the work that I do is predominantly in safety of emerging technologies. And from my perspective, ethics fundamentally sits under the safety umbrella. So if we are using a particular piece of technology in an unethical way, that to me means that we are using it in an unsafe way. So that's the reason why I think that it's fundamental to ask those questions.
Sure.
So the Army operates within a well-known and respected framework of law that regulates how we undertake or participate in armed conflict. So the use of AI doesn't in any way detract from Australia's obligations in how it conducts operations in time of war. And we pride ourselves on our ability to operate within and respect the laws of armed conflict.
Okay, so we're going to have an opportunity to explore your reasons in great depth shortly. Let's learn a little bit about you both now and how you came to find yourselves as respected experts in this area of autonomous systems and artificial intelligence. So, Zena, as a young person, can you remember when and how the areas of science and technology and engineering sparked a flicker of interest?
So I get asked this question a lot, and in the past I would make up a different answer. But over the years, I've come to give a more honest answer because I think it's more reflective of a lot of people's experiences. I had absolutely no idea what I wanted to do when I was younger. I wouldn't say that I was passionate about anything, but I was very good at math in high school, and I had a wonderful math teacher. His name was Mr. Constantinou, and he said to me, "You should do engineering. You're good at math." And I liked being good at math. Like, it felt good to be good at something. And so I did engineering and I did aerospace engineering, and everything kind of happened organically for me after that. But I wish I could say that I had that passion for it from when I was younger, but I honestly didn't. But I can happily say that that passion for it kind of grew over time, especially as I started to work professionally and I started to work in emerging technologies a little bit more deeply. And then that passion kind of fostered over time.
And so where did the excitement come from? Aerospace as well. There must be one moment in time where you thought to yourself, whoa, that's incredible. This is for me.
Honestly, I think it was when I was looking at what I wanted to do and I was reading all of the descriptions. Aerospace piqued my interest the most because I thought it would be really, really cool to be able to work on a plane. And this was my naive, very young self, right? Because I've never actually worked on one directly. And I would argue that many aerospace engineers haven't actually. But I remember thinking, wouldn't that be cool if I could work on a plane? And that was really what piqued my interest at the time. Mm-hmm. But yes, naively, I would imagine very few aerospace engineers actually work directly on aircraft. Yeah.
And so what does it actually mean to be an aerospace engineer? What do you get to do if you're not working on planes?
One of the really great things about not just an aerospace engineering degree, but I would say any engineering degree is just the sheer diversity of possible jobs that you could get out of an engineering degree. So I know from myself, before I started my academic career, I worked in industry and I worked specifically on the regulation of emerging aviation technologies. And I loved my job. But I know from myself and some of my colleagues that I graduated with, they're working in vastly different spaces. Some of them are working in the sustainability area. Some of them are working on different forms of transport, so automotive or trains. So I think one of the really great things about engineering is that it doesn't pigeonhole you. It really it gives you fundamental problem solving skills and opens up a lot of different pathways for you.
And Damien, what were your interests in your early years and how did that lead to an interest and then career in law?
So I think growing up, being a lawyer is not something I really seriously entertained. I did always at school enjoy history. And so the law is really all about history, particularly in our common law system. And so I think at some point I realised that becoming a lawyer was something that I would aspire to. And so having done so and joined the army as a lawyer, I was quite fortunate to get a range of experience, but in particular early in the piece as a junior army lawyer, I was given the opportunity to work in the international law area. And it's during that period that I was exposed to, I guess, two of the key aspects of my interest. One, the state obligation to undertake the legal review of weapons, because where I was working, the Directorate of Operations in International Law, that was one of the roles that they performed. And secondly, about that time, the possibility, the prospect of the use of autonomy in the military domain started to appear. And so there was this period where the use of AI and robotics was becoming less of a topic for, you know, Hollywood movies and more of a potential reality. And so I guess I was a bit lucky to sort of be in the right place at the right time when this started to occur, and over the years have had the opportunity to think about how we, in fact, from a legal perspective, can approach the challenges that the use of autonomy and artificial intelligence in the military context can be met. And so that was really the impetus behind my interest. And the subject of my research was on the issue of the legal review of autonomous weapon systems. And it's become very much an important aspect of the international debate. And I'm very pleased that I have the opportunity now as the Director of the International Law to contribute to the debate, in particular to help inform Australia's position on the application of international law to autonomous weapon systems.
And so to arrive where you are now, your PhD thesis considered the ability of international humanitarian law to regulate new technology weapons. What was the most challenging piece to consider and form your findings on through that thesis?
So I must admit, my thesis, it took me a little while to finish my PhD, probably longer than most.
PhDs are really challenging.
There's big smiles around the table
you
for the record.
You don't need to add caveats. PhDs are a really challenging experience.
And to be honest, the biggest challenge initially was that it very much was talking in the abstract, the potential for technology to be used in a particular context. There wasn't actually anything when I started that was, in fact, an actual military capability. So very much I was talking in the hypothetical and the abstract, but certainly in the last few years that's changed quite dramatically, and we now see a significant progression in the use of remote and to varying degrees automatic and heading towards autonomy within the military domain. I mean, the Army RICO program is a fantastic example yeah. of how autonomy and AI is being explored within the military context. So over the period of my research, I was fortunate that from the start to the finish, many of the, I guess, the hypotheticals actually now appear as practical and actual capabilities, which helped me enormously.
Yes, it must be very rewarding as well for something that you worked on and now seems to be coming to fruition.
I don't think I could have hoped, I guess, for a better timing, because I managed to finish it in time for this to be a reality. So I feel like I'm in the fortunate position of being in the right place at the right time, where, you know, the subject of my research is actually quite relevant to my day-to-day work.
So. Yeah. So often the terms ethics and law are used interchangeably. So I'm going to put this to both of you. Zana, can you define what makes your role unique?
I would say that what makes my role unique is that I'm very focused on practical outputs to complex theoretical problems. So a tagline I always use for a lot of my research is theory to practice. And this is a really challenging thing to do for a lot of reasons. So I'll keep with talking about ethics just for context.
Sure.
The hardest part about ethics is that it means different things to different people. It is a very subjective context and concept. What's ethical to me might not be ethical to you. And the other challenging part about ethics is that it changes drastically over time. What was ethical just even 5 years ago is not ethical today. And we've really experienced that in our society with like cancel culture and things like that. You mm-hmm. know, there were things that were not even considered normal, but just things people would gloss over really a few years ago. And today you'd absolutely be called up for it. So ethics is so contentious, I think. And when I started doing this work that I'm doing and I was diving into ethics, so I do work around trust and ethics, and I've actually gone so far as to define trust in my research. I have not defined ethics. And it's not that I'm saying I never will, but I think it's such a challenging thing, and it's really, really hard to translate the theory of ethics into practice in a way that would be accepted by many people but also equitable across the board to many people. And I still don't have the answers to that.
So we've got a highly qualified lawyer with us right here. The definition of ethics, please, Damien.
But I'd be lying if I said I had a good definition of ethics. I do certainly agree that ethics and law are very much related concepts. Mm-hmm. In many cases, the law, particularly with respect to the laws of armed conflict, are ethically, based. And so many of the humanitarian objectives of the law can be drawn from ethical principles. And, of course, the law is not complete. It is far from perfect and in many ways struggles to keep up with the pace of technological advancement. And in my view, this is where ethics play an important role to help inform how we approach the application of existing laws to the new problems. And we can certainly see in the context of current debate around the use of autonomy, certainly in the weapons context, that there are many ethical concepts, you know, relating to the need for human control, responsibility, accountability, trust. These sort of ethically based issues are very, very central to the debate.
Can I ask a question here? You mentioned the word control, and I know from a command and control perspective, or even meaningful human control, which are these, you know, concepts that get thrown around, people are really moving away from using the word control. Mm. Have you found that bleeding into your ethics and law work for why they're moving away from using this term?
To be honest, I think control has remained a very central element of the discussion, and the issue of control, variously described as meaningful or appropriate or adequate, there's any number of adjectives that states rely on to describe what they see as the necessary element of control. It's an issue which I think will continue to characterise the debate. And I think the issue is not about whether there should be, but how it is articulated. I know from the work that the Army's doing within the use of autonomy in the military domain, that the concepts around human machine teaming are very important, and implicit in this teaming is the control that might be applied. the UN debate under the auspices of the Convention on Certain Conventional Weapons is continuing. And in fact, the next meeting, the week after next, which is the first week in March 2024, I'd imagine that control will remain a hot topic as the participants struggle with what a regulatory framework may look like. And presently, the trajectory is towards a two-tiered approach to the regulation of autonomous weapon systems. And one of the issues is whether control is, or human control is a tier one, which in essence means in the absence, it is a prohibited, unlawful capability, or whether it is more a regulatory concept found in tier two, which means it's that is not a basis of a prohibition, but it is a requirement for the lawful use. So I think I've not seen it being stepped back. I think it remains an important concept, and yeah, it remains to be seen if there is sufficient common ground for states to agree.
Yeah, I think I've always found there's a dichotomy between the concept of control and then the concept of autonomy.
Yeah.
And so the contention I've found between, or well, with people using the term control is, how can we say that humans are controlling a system that is allegedly fully autonomous?
Yeah.
And then you get the whole liability argument. And so that's the reason why I was asking that question specifically from a legal perspective. I think I found that there's contention around this term because people are really concerned about where the liability will lie if something goes wrong, if we're saying a human is in control, but also the system operates autonomously.
That's right. And there are a number of ways that states have approached. Certainly Australia's position, which they articulated in 2018, was that there is a system of control.
So
control is not a binary concept. It's not on or off, but over the application of a autonomy which is enhanced by artificial intelligence, there is an entire system which includes a policy framework, a governance framework, the programming, the system design, how the operator actually uses the system. All of those are, I guess, elements of a broader control system. Yeah,
I like that, system of control.
Write it down. Let's explore control in a real life event, and we're going to throw in the word trust here as well. Zena, a considerable amount of your work revolves around trust of autonomous systems. What does it mean to be a trusted system?
So I said before that I have gone so far in my research as to define trust. Mm. And the way that I defined it is confidence in the reliability of a system. So how confident am I that this system is going to behave in the way that I expect it to behave? And I've defined it like that for a few reasons. Firstly, I'm coming at this from an engineer's perspective. So when I look at defining something, particularly when I want to capture it, I do a lot of systems engineering. So I want to capture this in a risk assessment. How can I quantify or qualify that and or demonstrate that? So that's part of the reason. And then the second reason is similar to ethics, trust is very subjective. However, I would argue that trust is also a little bit more contained in how we define it. So I think with human-to-human trust, that one's a little bit trickier. There are different behaviors and things that we do and say that can make people either trust us more or trust us less. And that's because human beings are quite nuanced and unpredictable. And I would argue that an autonomous or an AI system is not the same as a human. It is not as nuanced and it is not as unpredictable. And so the idea of using the way that we describe human trust in autonomous systems, I think there's definitely an element of translation there for sure. However, I do think that we need to view autonomous and AI-enabled systems through a different lens. And so those were quite motivating factors for me when I was choosing to define trust.
Hmm.
Now, I'm not saying that this is the only correct decision. I always have to add this caveat. There are other definitions of trust, working definitions that have been out there. This is just the definition that I have put forward and that I'm working against in my research.
Sure.
I think trust is a really fascinating concept. From a legal perspective, it's not a concept that the law deals with. So there's no international law that requires trust in a particular way. But I think it's very clear that it is implicit in many of the legal obligations. So, for example, in the context of the law regulating means and methods of warfare, the law requires those who plan or decide upon an attack to make certain decisions. That includes anticipating the harm or the collateral damage that might be caused from the use of force in a particular circumstance. And I would say implicit in that is a degree of trust that the mechanism by which you're causing that harm, the weapon system you're using, you need to trust it's going to perform in a way that you can that would allow you to anticipate in a reliable, in a dependable, in a predictable way. And so I think whilst trust is not a word that you'll find, it's certainly a concept that is very relevant. One of my favourite analogies in terms of trust is one that relates to the use of a military working dog. So the military has dogs they use for various things, detection of mines, for example, mm-hmm. or explosives. And there's trust between the handler and the dog. And the handler, I think, trusts based on the training and the knowledge and the understanding of the dog's capabilities. And that trust is manifest in how far the trainer will allow the dog off the leash.
Oh, that's interesting.
If the trainer doesn't trust the dog in a particular context, then it will keep it on a short leash.
Yeah.
Alternatively, if it does have confidence and faith and trust the dog to perform as it is directed to do in a particular context, it'll let it off the leash, for example, and trust that it can call it back. And so I think that analogy would apply to the use of autonomy or AI in some military context, because the operator who doesn't trust the system in a particular operational circumstance may well have almost complete control over the system and not allow the autonomous system to make its own decisions. But mm-hmm. equally, if it does trust it in a different circumstance, it will allow it to do more tasks without that direct human control.
Yeah, yeah. These are the overtrust and undertrust yes. arguments. Yeah,
yeah.
yeah.
Zena, you recently wrote for the ABC about a situation in San Francisco where trust was not the outcome of a series of events. Can you explain what happened for anyone who is not aware?
Yeah, so I can't remember if it was October or November last year, there was a rollout of robo-taxis across the city of San Francisco. And that rollout ended in a couple of different accidents. One was one of the robo-taxis driving into wet cement on a construction site. Another one was a robo-taxi crashing into an emergency vehicle. So it was a fire truck. It didn't stop for the fire truck at an intersection and crashed through it. And then there was another one where the robo-taxi was stuck in the middle of the street and wasn't going. And so it was holding up a lot of traffic. And those were just a few. There were a few others as well. And the outcome of that was that crews ended up recalling all of their robo-taxis. And so the article that I wrote for the ABC was investigating this idea of premature rollouts of technology in a race to be the first. So I think emerging technology, autonomy and AI is so popular right now. Everybody wants to get on the autonomy and the AI bandwagon. And it's such a competitive market and a competitive industry that I think people are prematurely releasing technology into the wild without a proper understanding of how that technology is going to work in the wild.
Mm.
I have said this on multiple different platforms. Human beings are the most unpredictable system to ever exist. It is not just about the safety of technology. It's about the safety of technology integrating with humans. So there's this idea that well, there are statistics actually that robo-taxis or autonomous cars in general will result in however many percent less accidents per year over roads. I think that statistic would be real if all of the taxis on the road were autonomously driven or autonomously operated. But if you've got autonomous cars and humans driving their cars, that statistic is absolutely not correct.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think this is something that people, when they think about trust is a two-way street, right? And I'm not saying that autonomous and AI-enabled systems have the capacity to trust. I don't believe that they do. I don't believe in anthropomorphizing these systems. But what I'm saying is that there is an element of trust between the back-end system of these technologies, so the people who are developing, designing them, and implementing them, and then the end users and the people who will be interacting with them. And that trust is a two-way street. And so when you prematurely release these robo-taxis into the middle of San Francisco and basically all hell breaks loose, of course you're going to have people who are already skeptical of these technologies being like, I knew it wasn't going to work. And so I just think it was, I think they just probably got a little bit too excited and a little bit too optimistic in trying to push out this technology too soon.
Would you get into one?
Absolutely not. If all of the cars on the road were autonomously driven, I would get into one.
Uh-huh.
But if I'm in this car and somebody is driving their car alongside, absolutely not. I would not get into it.
Damien?
I think I'd probably give it a go.
You're braver than me.
Perhaps only if they were speed limited and perhaps had their own lane to drive in or something like that. Yeah. But I think I'd probably
it's like in the bowling alley when they put up the guardrail.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, Zenny, you talk about this speed to get the products out there. Defence really is facing a similar context. How do we ensure that we deliver cutting-edge technologies at speed but ensure these trusted systems when lives are now at risk?
I think regulation has always lagged behind any technology implementation, and that is just the nature of regulation. Regulation is conservative, it takes time, and regulation can't be rolled out as quickly as technology can. That's just a fact. I don't think regulation will ever catch up to technology. I think we need to live with the fact that technology will be implemented at a much faster pace than regulation. What I do think we can do, though, is be strategic about that extra time that we have. So I come from the aviation industry, and aviation regulations are notoriously reactive. They create regulations in response to a problem as opposed to in anticipation of one. I think with the rate at which technology is being implemented and the slower pace of regulations, this is an opportunity to be a little bit more anticipatory and strategic in what our regulations look like.
Mm.
But I think that the goal of trying to meet the speed of technology development, I don't think we will ever meet that. So I think we need to accept that we can't and then try and be strategic with lagging behind. How can we use that extra time to be more strategic?
I think that also rings true in the international law environment. Typically, the law is reactive and behind issues that become to international attention and generate the type of national sentiment that is necessary for states to develop new laws. There are examples where the law has been preemptive, but they are rare. And certainly the case with the autonomous weapon systems, there's very much a wide-ranging debate and yet to be a clear consensus on how the law should regulate, if at all, the use of autonomy in armed conflict. So I think you're absolutely right.
Do you find it challenging? I always find the argument of law in armed conflict really challenging to reconcile because armed conflict, I think, is very hard to put boundaries around, right? Like it's supposed to be unpleasant.
Mm.
And so I've always found it really challenging to reconcile law and armed conflict. So how do you manage that?
Yeah, I think you're right. Really, the law of armed conflict is a balance between two competing principles. The military necessity of using force to achieve a military and ultimately a state end, but that's balanced against the need to protect the victims of armed conflict. And so, you know, this balance is a continual challenge that the law seeks to reconcile. It certainly has been clear as the law developed in modern time, particularly after the Second World War, that states' rights to choose means and methods of warfare is not unlimited. And really, that's a fundamental principle that much of my work is rests, and certainly a lot of the law that regulates the use of weapon systems is based upon. But you're right, the law doesn't protect or prevent horrible things, harm to combatants in armed conflict, but it does aim to protect the innocent victims of armed conflict.
Gee, it's very easy for us to sit here in a quiet studio talking about this sort of thing. It's a very different space when you're on the ground facing real bullets coming at you.
Right. But I think it's such an important issue for states, and certainly the ADF takes its obligations extremely seriously.
Sure.
And so really the compliance with the law of armed conflict is central to ADF training, and that goes equally in terms of how it develops and acquires its capabilities, and very much in the forefront of the use of artificial intelligence in a military context is how do we do so in a way that's consistent with our international law obligations.
Yeah.
And certainly that's a significant part of what we do in my organisation.
The Defence Strategic Review instructs Defence to shift its acquisition process with a view to acquiring minimum viable capability in the shortest possible time frame. How is Defence maintaining legal adherence in shorter time frames, Damien?
The process that we use to undertake a determination of legality is called the Article 36 weapon review process. And that's an obligation that Australia has as a state party to the first additional protocol to the Geneva Conventions. So we have, in fact, in the last couple of years, put a lot of work into refining our approach in order to ensure that it is sufficiently responsive and able to meet the accelerated timelines that Defence are looking to achieve in terms of its study, development, acquisition and adoption of new capabilities. I'm proud to say that we've done a lot of good work, and it's in fact something that we are contributing to international discussion. My team over the last 2 years has hosted expert meetings on the legal review of autonomous weapon systems, and that has helped to establish what we hope will be a mechanism for the international exchange of best practice, so that all states who are doing as the ADF is doing, rapidly acquiring these systems, can adequately determine legality prior to their use in armed conflict. One thing, it's important that the legal review process is a national process, and so states are very much at liberty to determine how they go about their approach. I think that the approach Australia's taking in its legal review is world leading, and I'm confident that it allows us to make a good determination, a solid determination of the legality of these systems before they are acquired and used in armed conflict.
I like that we're world leading. That's exciting, because we're not world leading in every industry, so it's nice for us to be world leading, especially in something I think as topical as this.
Yeah.
We know when it comes to ethics, as we've already heard, that everything's not black and white, of course. What are some of the conversations that you're having amongst the legal fraternity? Is there robust conversations? Is there opposite points of view, and happy for both of you to have an opinion on that?
So there is a wide range of views on the various aspects of how law does and should regulate the use of artificial intelligence in the military context. In particular, in the last few years, we have seen a number of states, for example, the Netherlands and the Republic of Korea, instigated a program on the responsible use of artificial intelligence in the military domain, REAIM, and a very important work has been done last year and will happen again this year towards, I guess, enabling a discussion on how the law, how ethics apply in terms of AI. I think this year will be a significant year also in how the UN debate progresses. There is a new mandate for the UN to continue to explore elements of a legally binding or elements of regulation of autonomy in the military. And interestingly, the United Nations General Assembly last year, for the first time, issued a resolution calling upon all states to determine how to best regulate the use of autonomy in armed conflict. And I think we're very much at a pivotal point in terms of how international law will respond to these challenges.
The only thing I'll add to that is, in a lot of these discussions, I find there's a stark absence of the narrative around humans and human roles and responsibilities in armed conflict. And I think that even with the implementation of autonomous and AI-enabled systems, I don't believe that the liability has fully removed from humans. I think that we still play the most pivotal and critical role, not just in armed conflict, but in any other application of autonomous and AI-enabled capabilities. So for me, moving forward with the ethical discussion, whenever I have this discussion, I always try, and this is not me entirely removing the lens from autonomous and AI-enabled systems, sort of reshifting it. Because I find as soon as we use the words autonomy or AI-enabled, people have quite a common misconception of these systems entirely operating independently, having the capacity to reason, having the capacity to make decisions in absence of human beings. And that's not entirely correct. And so from my perspective, when I have these discussions around ethics, I always try and reintroduce the discussion around human roles and responsibilities, which I think is still an incredibly critical discussion.
Yeah,
I couldn't agree more. AI, autonomy, they're merely tools.
Yeah.
And so they don't remove at all the responsibility that both individuals and states have under international law for, you know, their conduct and for any harm that they may cause in an armed conflict. So I absolutely agree. Sometimes there is a misconception as to how autonomy will be used in a military or armed conflict situation, but to me that they are always a tool that humans are responsible for their application, and as from a legal perspective, the law holds states and their agents, individuals, legally responsible and accountable, not their tools.
So, Zenit, how then can we build appropriate AI knowledge across our fighting force to ensure the informed usage of AI?
I'm a huge advocate for education and training for any AI-enabled tool that is going to be implemented. When people talk about AI, they talk about it as though AI is going to be an entirely unpredictable system with the capacity to operate entirely independently of humans. And that's not correct. AI-enabled systems will absolutely have some level of unpredictability associated with their use, but that unpredictability is bounded, and it's bounded by the machine functions, so what it is designed to do, and the machine capabilities, so what it actually can and can't do. So things like, for example, if you had an autonomous weapon system, that autonomous weapon system is not going to magically predict the weather while it's operating. That's not within its capacity and within its functions. And so from my perspective, education and training on the realities of what this system can do, what this system can't do, and where the unpredictability is and what those boundaries are around that unpredictability is going to be really quite critical.
And so what level of responsibility do commanders have when using AI then?
I would, and Damien, correct me if I'm wrong, but I would argue it's the same level of responsibility for any other weapon system or any other tool that is used in an army context, right? Whether it be a vehicle or an aircraft or a weapon, like any kind of tool, there is responsibility of the person who's using that tool to fully understand the limits of it. So I think it's the same with AI-enabled tools. I think the knowledge and the practices exist. I think they just need to be translated.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Commanders are ultimately responsible for those things within their command. That includes the use of autonomous systems. And so the obligation on both the operator and those in command of the operator is to know and understand, to only apply the system in a way that it's intended and apply it in circumstances where it's capable of being used. I think Zena is absolutely right that training is critical, so that there is a good understanding as to capabilities and limitations of a system and the risks that may be inherent when it should and shouldn't be used. It's also important, of course, that in the study and development acquisition, there is a rigorous test and evaluation process so that risks that are inherent or within the system can be addressed either by resolving the technical aspect of the risk or altering how the system might be used to mitigate that risk. And certainly one of the outputs of our legal review process is to make recommendations as to how a system can be used so as to minimise legal risk. And so if we identify a particular use case where there is a legal risk, then we would recommend that the system not be used so as to minimise or avoid such risks.
I think I would agree with that. I don't actually have anything else to add. That was really well said.
Yeah. Write that down then. Exactly, really. So, Damien, as a military, how do we ensure adherence to our international law obligations of AI and emerging technology, both through the development phase and then on the battlefield?
So there are two broad aspects to fulfilling our international law obligations in the context of the use of weapons in the armed conflict. Firstly, is to make sure that the weapon or the system itself is lawful. And that's predominantly what the outcome of the Article 36 legal review is to do, is to determine whether that system is lawful in accordance with Australia's international legal obligations. That, though, is then complemented by the laws that regulate the actual use. So a lawful weapon can be used in an unlawful way. And that's why the laws regulate how a particular weapon can be used. For example, it's prohibited to target civilians and civilian objects. It's prohibited to cause collateral damage that is excessive in relation to the anticipated military objectives. So therefore, the users of the system, that is the operators and the commanders who are responsible, need to be trained in those legal obligations as they are, and understand how they are applied in the context of that particular capability.
Mm. Damien, considering our broader audience now, can you give us a brief explanation of Article 36?
My team are, in fact, on a bit of a mission to demystify Article 36. It's not a well understood process, and so what we're very keen to do is to help people understand what it is. The way we conduct an Article 36 review, which is similar to a number of states, is essentially four steps. The first preliminary step is to ascertain whether, in fact, something is subject to an Article 36 review. And the question that we do in that case is what we are considering a weapon, means, or method of warfare. Mm-hmm. Now, the use of artificial intelligence in the weapon context presents some interesting discussions. For example, whether or not an artificial intelligence command decision tool that, for example, might recommend targets, whether that is part of the weapon system, and I would suggest it is. Step one is to look at the specific international law prohibitions and restrictions. And so Australia is party to all of the international law treaties that either prohibit or restrict the use of weapons. So that I'm talking about chemical, anti-personnel, cluster munitions, those type of specific treaties, in addition to those prohibitions which are recognised as customary international law, and that means that that applies to all states. Step two is where we look at the general international law prohibitions that relate to not a specific weapon itself, so for example, a chemical weapon, but relates to the effects that all weapons might cause. And the key elements of that is whether or not a weapon is capable of being used in a discriminate manner, that is, it can hit what it's aimed at. And of course, that's important so as to not have indiscriminate effects. The other key element of the general prohibitions is whether the weapon causes superfluous injury or unnecessary suffering to combatants. And so what that looks to is whether or not a weapon will cause more harm to the combatant than is militarily necessary. The final step, the third step, is quasi-legal in its nature because it allows us to then to consider broad range of national policy, the prospect of future law, other elements such as the ethical dimensions that might be relevant. And having completed those steps, the outcome is really a recommendation as to whether that the weapon is lawful. It's lawful but restricted from use in certain circumstances, or is unlawful. Now, one of the aspects of our review of our approach is to look at adding an additional step to deal with specifically autonomous functions in weapons, and we refer to that as the functional review step. And the purpose of that is to identify those functions that are performed by artificial intelligence that have in some way are governed by the laws of armed conflict. So, for example, if a weapon has a function to track, detect, and classify either an object or a person, then that is regulated by the laws of armed conflict, and we would look specifically at that function within the context of use cases that are consistent with its normal or expected use and its anticipated operating environments. So that's a process that we are putting into place to deal specifically with autonomy in weapon systems. And so that process is done by my team. We draw on multidisciplinary expertise from within defence, from operators, from engineers, from medical staff.
I can't imagine being in the room when you're discussing something. You have all these different people with very different perspectives on it.
That's right.
But I do like the proportionality of the approach you're taking.
Yeah.
I don't believe in a unified approach that would equally cover all, because, you know, autonomous and AI-enabled systems come at different levels. There's different levels of autonomy. Yeah. It's really a spectrum.
And also we're looking at not doing the review as a sort of a snapshot in time, but having the ability to, throughout the life cycle of a system, consider its legality. So in its development, then that's more in terms of informing its development so that it is lawful by design, as opposed to worrying about the legal implications later. In the acquisition stage, we'd make the determination as required by the law. And then in the in-service life, then there's more of a governance to ensure that any issues that arise in its use can be identified and considered as to whether it has any effect on the legality.
And I imagine at some point you'd have to include decommissioning into that as well.
That's right.
Especially if you're retaining data
and information. Right, yeah.
That's another Pandora's box. That's another
principle. That's a whole new podcast.
Decommissioning autonomous and AI-enabled systems is, I think that's going to be a huge point of research in the next few years.
Yeah. So we considered the word control earlier on. How do we decide what level of human control is appropriate for a system from, first of all, a legal standpoint and then an ethical standpoint?
I think it's very context dependent. I think this is the reality of autonomous and AI-enabled systems. We're seeing them kind of pushed out into the world under every possible domain, every possible application. So it's going to be very context dependent. I don't think there will be one answer that will apply to all different applications. So from a military perspective, I would say that the level of control will depend on the application of the system. Yeah. And then what that looks like, I truly don't know. And I actually imagine, and this is, I think, really hard for people to say, but I imagine that there will have to be a bit of trial and error. And I think it's hard for people to say, because when you talk about something in a military context, people are like, but you should know the answer and you're using this in a military context and there are high risks. Mm. And I think there's an element of truth to that. But there are also different levels of military operations. There's logistical transport. That's pretty low risk, especially if you're doing it on home soil. So, you know, I know the Army has the leader follower vehicle and they've done public trials on public roads. And they went fantastic and, you know, they were able to interact with the different state level governments on getting clearances to get that through. So there are trial and error approaches that you can do in really safe contexts, I think. So I think exploring that a little bit more would be really exciting.
No, I think you've really considered the right approach in terms of risk. In my view, there is a risk-based analysis that should be undertaken during the legal review, so during our functional review step, in order to mitigate legal risk by ensuring sufficient human control over a system such that where there is a high risk, there is more human control and the opposite. We have considered models that are used in the maritime environment, in the autonomous vehicle environment, and we are looking at a policy-based approach such that we would make recommendations as to, you know, the level of human control such that it would avoid legal risk in particular circumstances. That's an ongoing piece of work, but it's certainly something that we're quite interested in.
I'll add an interesting point to that. So when Army did their leader follower vehicle trial on public roads, obviously they liaised with state governments and made sure they were following all the rules and had proper approvals and everything. And one of the challenging parts about that was public trust. You've got two large Army vehicles driving on the road. And even though it's logistical transport, people are curious, why are they on the roads, blah, blah, blah. And this was just two vehicles on the road for a couple of hours. Mm. Now, if we compare this to what we were talking about before, which was the San Francisco rollout, this was dozens of vehicles in the heart of San Francisco rolled out. And, you know, with at least with the leader follower vehicles, there was proper transport both ahead and before as well, monitoring the vehicle. Like, it was very well thought out. It was very well designed. People thought about the public trust element. And what's interesting to me is those different contexts. When you look at a civilian application of a technology that is arguably going to be more dangerous because there was an entire fleet that was released into the heart of a city with no one really physically there monitoring them. And then you compare it to as soon as you add the military context onto it, and suddenly there are so many more guardrails, even though these were used literally for logistical transport and there were no civilian passengers who voluntarily got on board. So I think that context element, when you look at them side by side, is really interesting.
Yeah. And so as a follow-on from that, many people will, of course, argue that autonomous and uncrewed systems are unethical, and I'm sure you've heard those arguments, Senna. On the other hand, though, these systems are redefining the character of warfare, and Damien, I'm sure you've heard those arguments as well. Is there an ethical imperative for defence to invest in capabilities such as autonomous systems or the systems enhanced through AI to remove soldiers from the most dangerous of tasks, increase decision-making, and extend the first instance of human contact?
I think the argument of whether or not we should or shouldn't do it has passed because everybody is doing it and Australia can't fall behind. That's a reality. For me, when I think about the ethics of implementing these systems in any context, not just a military context, I go back to the argument I made before that human beings are the most unpredictable systems in the world. Mm. And yet we put them to fly planes and we put them to perform surgeries. And we've seen some of the extreme cases of how those things can go wrong. But we still continue to put humans in safety critical roles. So when you think about autonomous and AI-enabled systems in these roles, one thing I try and encourage is to think about how we can translate the scaffolding of boundaries that we put around humans to autonomous and AI-enabled systems. So using the pilot example, there are regulations around the amount of hours they're allowed to work, the fitness checks that they have to do. They have to go through psychological checks as well. They have to be retrained a certain amount of time. There's an entire infrastructure around making sure that this pilot who is performing a safety critical role is meeting I still think ethics sits under this umbrella of safety. So is meeting safety and ethical requirements. That psychological one, really, the requirements of pilots, I would argue that's an ethical one. And so it's the same with autonomous and AI-enabled systems. The issue that we have is that I think it's very intimidating to step forward and say, I think this is how we should do it. And when I was giving my definition of trust before, I had the huge caveat of saying, I'm not saying this is the only way, because it's so hard and challenging to do that. And I think that's really what a huge roadblock is for autonomous and AI-enabled systems. We have existing tools and mechanisms and processes, but it's really challenging and scary to come out and say, I think this is the way it should be done. And so because of that, we have very apprehensive approaches, very caveat-filled approaches like mine. And, you know, I put myself in that bracket as well. I'm someone who's also quite reserved in how I'm approaching this because it's constantly changing. Ethics, like we said, is very subjective. There's also the country-to-country kind of aspect as well. Different cultures approach things in different ways.
Completely.
So I think the point I'm trying to make is that I think that we have existing infrastructure that we can lean into. It's just about being able to strategically do that and then also having an audience capacity to kind of embrace it, I think.
I agree. And I think there is a very important part of the discussion is around the benefits that artificial intelligence can potentially provide in the military context. And as you said, benefits to the safety of removing our soldiers from harm's way, from reducing the risks that come from fatigue, for example. So there's certainly a good argument and an important part of the discussion around how artificial intelligence and autonomy can assist from a safety perspective, from a legal compliance perspective, from a number of perspectives. It's a very interesting aspect of the discussion around the use at which artificial intelligence is used or autonomy is used. And it's not hard to see in around the world now a number of military applications, probably not you'd call autonomous, you'd probably say automatic, very determinative programmed type systems designed for defensive purposes. So ship defense against missiles, for example, or ground defence against missiles or artillery. Defensive systems seem to not generate the same level of concern that the potential of offensive systems does raise. And I think this is where a balanced discussion around both the benefits and the negatives. Mm-hmm. I don't think anyone disagrees that there are any number of risks and challenges that the use of autonomy in an offensive way raise. But this is why we are putting so much time and effort into being able to make a solid determination as to the lawful use.
Okay. And so as we come towards the end of our discussion, thoughts from both of you here, please. When examining legal and ethical considerations of AI and military technologies, Anna, what's the number one thing that must happen right now?
I would say the number one thing that has to happen now is translating theory to practice. And this is what a lot of my work does. I think we have sat in the theory space for some time now, and I think we are ready to step forward and start putting things into practice. And I would say that there needs to be room for flexibility in that process. Not everything is going to be absolutely right the first time, but if we're not going to step forward and say, I think this is how it should be done, let's see if it works, let's iterate over time, then we're really not going to get anywhere. So I think that we need to take that step, start putting things into practice and allowing for an iterative approach.
Damien, from a legal stance?
So for me, it's all about the proper consideration of legal risks, and the mechanism to do that is in, as we've mentioned, the Article 36 legal review. And I think what is so important is that states undertake the legal review process to allow them to make a determination as to legality, both during the study, development and acquisition and during its the use of these systems, and that all states undertake a similar process and exchange what they regard as best practice so that the law as it applies right now can be applied appropriately in the context of these new technologies.
And so then looking ahead, what does that look like in 5 years' time?
The expert meetings that my team is hosting at the moment, our aim is to create a portal that is available to all states, in fact, available to everybody, to enable the exchange of best practice. And so in 5 years' time, I hope that there is ongoing discussion about how states can best achieve their legal reviews. And there is a portal or a or somewhere where this information can be easily exchanged. Those states who are developing their processes can benefit from the experience of other states, and that there is a common and relied process for states to undertake.
Yeah. So is that going to be publicly available to everyone?
That's right, yep.
I think that's fantastic. I think it's really great to be embracing something at such a public level, which is not common for the military in general.
Mm. And so ethically in 5 years' time, Zena?
In 5 years' time, I hope to have the courage to define ethics. That's my five-year goal. In 5 years' time, I want to have this conversation again and I want to say, this is how I have defined ethics.
Okay, you're on record. Yeah. We'll be back in 5 years. Dr. Zena Assad and Colonel Damien Copeland, thank you so much for your insights and your expertise. This has been a fascinating discussion on this episode of the Adapting Army podcast. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
So there you have it. And we say thanks for listening to this episode of the Adapting Army podcast series. To hear more stories of Army's adaptation, subscribe to The Cove via Apple Podcasts or Spotify.